We'll call the meeting to order. As you know, that we've been talking about having time on the council's calendar to think about strategic issues and step out of the routine day-to-day work. It took us something like 3 years to finally get around to having this meeting. Thank you, John, for finding time for us. Today's agenda is informal. I kind of wish we weren't at a dais and in the formal council setting, because I'd really like it to be open and back and forth. So this isn't a presentation model. If you have things to say, say them. To the extent that we can, I really would like to generate open conversation. So with that in mind, no agenda, no particular direction that we'd like to go. So let's start the conversation. Jim and Alan, I think we have you up for the first hour just in terms of structure. We have been asked to stay on schedule, so we have an hour for the first part of the conversation and an hour for the second part. The first part will focus us on understanding different asset allocation models that we could think about and compare ourselves to other organizations around the world. The second hour of the discussion will be a values and beliefs discussion. It is a follow-up to our original values and beliefs that were set 4 years ago, John? 3 years ago or so?
Five
years ago. Good God. Okay. It's rock and roll. Let's learn something.
Hi. Jim Callahan for the record. Staff prepared some slides here based on a whole different set of inputs to try to, in a succinct way, summarize some of the major differences and attributes between different institutional models of management. So if it makes sense, we can just kind of walk through this, but certainly please stop us at any point along the way. You have two sets of slides in front of me here. The only difference is that the first set is for the 10-year period, ended December of last year, and then the second set is for a 20-year period. So you'll note that there isn't really any difference in the main attributes for the 10 and 20-year periods, except for performance. Certainly, the capital market environment over the last 10 years has rewarded publicly traded equities, especially U.S. equities. Alternative asset classes haven't kept up, and so that's influenced how some of these investors have performed over the 10-year period of time. So you'll note that there's some performance differences for the distinctions between the 10 and the 20 years, and I'll highlight that.
Hey, Jim.
Yes?
Can we set up this up and down arrow system compares the performance over 10 years to our asset allocation, right? Is that the basic
yes.
framework? Okay, so the up and down is in comparison to ours. Okay.
I may look around if you ask some specific questions, just because I think Carl took the lead on preparing some of this.
Oh, yeah, and then
I understand it.
They sent you up to talk.
Maybe you want to be
Carl, why don't you come up and join them? We want to.
Sure.
Thanks. So is Friday normally a casual day for you guys?
Yeah, I dress very casually. I say happy fast.
Nice. You didn't need to wear it. You can take your ties off for your jacket.
Rick?
I'm following my boss's lead, so I'm
okay. All right.
Okay. So I've got some help here if I need it. So the four basic models that are presented to you here on these slides, so start on the left with titled low cost and passive. I think this was intended to represent public funds that tend to have simple models in terms of their asset allocation models and how they implement those models. So they're not necessarily all passively invested per se. They may employ some active management, but some of these tend to use a fair amount of passive investments. They tend to have low exposure to alternatives, than the average for the public pension universe. So those, there you'll see on the slides, there are some, I think there are about 7 or 8 different plans, state plans that were identified that kind of fit that model. That's how that group was identified. The second set is U.S. endowment, and this is intended to represent large university endowments.
Yeah, if I may.
Sure.
I didn't let you finish the sentence. That's good. Question here.
That's good.
We've always thought ourselves as lean, so there are entities like ours that are even leaner. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, very much so.
Really?
Yes.
I guess we compare ourselves to CalPERS, for example.
Well,
I don't know about that comparison, John.
CalPERS is not part of this definition of this group here, but just for an example, one of the funds that's in this is the State of Nevada, which actually is one of Janet's clients, and they have one investment person.
Brilliant. I will show up.
How much in assets?
They are, what, about $10 billion, Janet?
Oh, we're like 40.
Oh, well,
that's
40?
Yeah.
See, they're about 40.
Not your
fault. For some reason, I thought they were smaller than that. Yeah. But they're very, so 70-30 model, right, Janet? And you can, maybe Janet, you can chime in.
Sure.
There's a fourth chair up here, by the way.
Hey, Janet.
I'm happy to let you too. This is a trade-off for Wednesday. Nevada's running a long-term plan of ours, and they do have a very, very simple model. Their U.S. equity exposure is all benchmarked to the S&P 500, no mid, small cap, 100% passive. All their fixed income is now treasuries, benchmarked against the U.S. Treasury Index, and they have 10% of their portfolio, and they have an international equity allocation that's all EFA, no emerging, no small cap, all passive. So all their equities is 100% passive, all their fixed income is 100% passive, and they have 10% alternatives split by to real estate and 5 to private equity. And that's one person.
So then how many of you support that one person? So they have one person on staff, but then does it take 50 people supporting them, or is it just you?
No, they have one person. They used to have two, and now they have one. And if you're interested in how they kind of got there, I can give you just a short perspective. On
Come up, Janet, please, my dear. This is what you get for being smart.
So Cowan has worked with the bank for a really long time, and they used to have active management, and they have just been gradually carrying it back over the years, and they kind of got down to where the active management was so small that they felt it really wasn't worth the board time, because they were having some issues with their active managers, as all funds do at some point in time. And the board just said, you know, this is too small a part of our portfolio. It's taking way too much of the board time. We're just going to make it all passive. And then the key philosophy, too, was that they had a very strong CIO who philosophically really believed that the biggest levers that the board could pull were asset allocation. Right, because that determines that's the primary determinant of the plan's performance. The politics of the state were also an issue as well. So they had when they came out of the financial crisis, Nevada got hit particularly hard. Las Vegas was one of the areas, of course, where they had a lot of spec housing. It really collapsed. A lot of the state revenues were derived from gambling. Gambling revenues just went off a cliff after the financial crisis. So the state was kind of in a world of hurt. So they furloughed a lot of people. And so when all this kind of happened, they said, okay, we got to get lean and mean because we can't afford to hire people. We can't afford to pay them. They can't. This is also very important that the compensation for the public employees in the state of Nevada is very, very low. So they couldn't get people in, quality people in. And that's one of the really important parts here is staff. Staffing and how you build your team. They couldn't do that. They couldn't afford to pay them. So they went to a lean model as a result of kind of all these confluence of events. And the CIO that was there at the time, they couldn't pay him what he thought he needed to get paid. So he left to open up his own firm in the state. And so it's kind of evolved this way. But the way that the board thinks now is, and they're completely coherent in this, is that the biggest thing that they can do, the biggest lever that they can pull, is asset allocation. So that's where the board focuses. Almost 100, they focus 100% of the time there. The performance reviews are minutes.
And do they have a combined liabilities and asset board?
sorry?
Do they have an investment board and a liability?
No, it's
one
combined.
Board.
It's okay. Combined. Yes. So there's no separate, like, PERS board, OIC concept. Mm-hmm. No. It's all one board. Mm-hmm. And the state is has been pushing hard for years to convert them to a DC plan, so they had to operate in kind of an adversarial environment with the state legislature, too. So it's been a challenge for them. Mm-hmm.
So I guess the one question I have is, as you're looking across the four different categories here, the one column that, or the one row that I would like to hear more about is the risk level, just from an asset allocation perspective. Are the low-cost passive and U.S. corporate, from an asset allocation perspective, taking a lower level or higher level of risk compared to U.S. endowment and Canadian model?
You need to define risk. Because risk for corporates in today's world is an accounting issue.
Right.
And so their whole strategy is driven by liabilities and decreasing liabilities.
Right.
The endowments have the ability to change how much they spend. So they're not like a public pension plan where they have, every year they have to give out X, they have bad investment experience, they can reduce the giving. It's hard because you make commitments, but they can do it. The Canadians, you know, it's called a Canadian model, but it's not like every single Canadian plan is structured the same way, just like American public pension plans aren't all structured. People really talk about a handful of really jumbo funds that have very large internal staffs that are highly compensated, that are effectively private sector model investment organizations. And so you have Owners, you have Case & Depot, you have the OP Trust, and a couple Ontario Teachers. Some of the smaller ones have tried it, and it hasn't been that successful. It's not just a model. You've got the best model in the world. If you have the right people implementing the model, it doesn't make any difference. And the classic example is the endowment model. In the endowment model, Harvard and Yale have two well-known models. Well, everyone talks about Yale. You should talk about Harvard. Disaster. Disaster. They were heavily geared. And they made huge bets in the financial crisis. They ended up having to sell their private equity portfolio at a discount because of bad play. So looking at these labels, it's not simple. And it really comes down to execution and the quality of the people, not just the business model, in my opinion.
No, I agree with everything you just said. I guess the only reason I'm asking, maybe just focusing on the low-cost passive area.
What I would just add to that would be that taking U.S. corporates out for a second, because I think they are a different beast. If you were to compare the three on the left, I think it's safe to say that the low-cost passive model is less diversified than the U.S. endowment and the Canadian model as they're being represented here. So they're going to tend to be, again, less than alternative investments. They're going to have more publicly traded assets. They're not
and
as complex.
Is their asset,
so they're not
is their asset allocation similar to ours? It's still dominated by equity.
All of these have comparable asset allocations, but with the big, obviously, difference being the alternative allocation. But if you were to look at just general stock and bond exposure, if you were to just lump everything into those two categories,
right,
it's going to be comparable. Some of these may be a little more conservative. They might have a little more bond exposure than you do.
Right. So is it fair for me to make a statement that we are maybe trading a desire for a higher level of diversification, higher level of complexity for the desire for a lower portfolio level standard deviation? Is that fair to say? But it sort of seems to me that the low-cost passive are probably, I'm guessing, because of less reliance on alternatives, probably, as you said, a less diversified portfolio with a similar asset allocation. So I'm making the assumption that they are a riskier portfolio, again, from a standard deviation perspective.
Maybe.
Maybe, okay.
Because,
I think that's the part I'm trying to better understand.
Yeah. I think a true statement would be they have less active management risk.
Okay, so less tracking error to their benchmark.
So they're gonna be tracking their benchmarks much more closely. In fact, they've made a conscious decision that they don't, that that's not either implementable given their staffing or whatever reasons. That doesn't mean their standard deviation is necessarily higher or lower, because then the asset allocation can vary between those simple models from a 70-30 to a 60-40.
And
right, so it's hard to generalize that.
The Nevada example is really the extreme of the group as well.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the far end of the simple, low-cost, passive. The others that are in this universe that we're collecting are not nearly as simple as that. But they're using active management for, but again, the biggest difference is probably just going to be their alternative exposures.
But Jim, the Nevada's, for example, equity would all be public equity.
They have a small little bit of private, but not
private equity. Right. So if you lump equities all together, then you miss a major point, I think, at risk.
But there is a difference in asset allocation. Using the Yale Harvard and not all endowments, they need a lot more venture capital. They need a lot more hedge funds. They're in a whole series of strategies that smaller size allows them that may not be at all applicable to someone who's got $80 billion to invest. That's a point. The Canadian model, they're heavy on infrastructure. They're very heavy on real estate. They're very heavy on direct investments in the private markets. All of those aren't priced in the public market. So you're going to see a level of volatility that shows up much lower. But that's perception, not reality.
Mm-hmm.
And Jim's right. You get the corporates. They're not in the investment business anymore. They're in the defeasing business. And it's very important. I mean, they learned a terrible lesson in that, you know, big corporate pension plans, they were losing more money on their balance sheet from their pension plan than they were from operations. So they said, and then there was an accounting change, and you combined those two, and they said, we're getting out of it. With a model in the old days, was the AT&T pension plan and the General Motors pension plan. And that was the model. They were smart. Big internal staff, huge private market exposure. They're winding those down. But all of the ones that people talk to that are successful, it's not just the business model. It's the willingness to get the right people. You get the flexibility to implement a strategy and keep them. And the investment business, in my opinion, and this whole thing is interesting, but the issue is the business model. There are constraints. You have to look at your constraints. The question is, can you get the right people to make the implementation?
Well, I'm following up on that, Alan, if I may. Is the lesson that Harvard didn't pay enough?
No, they might pay too much.
Yeah.
I mean, definitely on a risk-adjusted basis, they pay too much. I mean, they were paying people $5, $10, $15 million a year, and you know, this is a public record, so I'm not going to say they were cowboys. But looking at them, they appeared to be cowboys. They were making all sorts of strange, very obscure investments, and you have to look at what their motivation was. And so much of their compensation was tied to performance. They looked at risk, in my opinion, and I don't have all the facts, I wasn't directly involved. They were driven by their bonus. They weren't driven by what was in the best interest of the investment portfolio. They had all these different silos. And people doing really obscure investments trying to get a couple hundred basis points more return.
And I gather they didn't have club X.
No. So the clawback will be, we'll take our money.
So that was a different model, too. Yale's fairly lean compared to Harvard historically in terms of the people. Harvard, in doing all that, was doing direct investments as well. They were kind of trying to do what the Canadians were doing, right? So it was a lot of direct investing. Yale doesn't do a lot of direct or much of any, so they're using external managers like you, for the most part. And that's, I would say, more typical of the U.S. endowment model. Yale was a little bit of an outlier in that, and that's being, I think, rethought and unwound right now.
So, Carl, is it right to think that it's not quite the same as a low-cost passive model, but the investing we do for SAFE, which is asset and liability matched, and mostly bonds and listed equities, that would kind of fit into the low-cost, if we were to segregate it?
If you were to put it in a box, I would put it there, or the U.S.
It would look more
like corporate. Yeah.
It would look like it's an insurance company, and the portfolio is managed like an insurance company.
But most of the claims are relatively short, so it's not intuitive.
It's not like life insurance. It's, you know, it's casualty insurance, right. So it's a different way of investing.
Right.
So then on top of the staffing levels, we have implemented Aladdin 2, which is, in my mind, I think of it as a tool to assess risk and understand what's in the underlying portfolio. So I assume that low-cost plans don't need that kind of analytic overlay to understand the risk that they have in the portfolio, right?
Well, most likely. I mean, I think a lot of low-cost plans may still have some tool available to them. But I also draw the distinction that Oregon State Treasury is different in the sense that we're not just looking at the pension plan, but we're also managing a $18 billion short-term fund and half a dozen other pools of money that the fixed income team is responsible for. And so there is a whole set of infrastructure in place to support those efforts that the peers on that slide may not have to watch out for.
Mm-hmm.
And just on that point, to the best of my knowledge, every one of our large public fund clients uses Aladdin. Or if they don't use Aladdin, they use Borrow. They're using one of the risk systems, even if their client, one client uses 100% of their U.S. equities in that. And they use it religiously. And they do all sorts of modeling with it. They do scenario analysis. And they make an attempt to model the real estate assets and the private equity, at least they can look at industry, capitalization, things like that, to kind of try to understand where the risks are embedded in the portfolio.
Okay. Shall we move to the next column?
So we've kind of defined the different models here. Again, I think, you know, the corporate model is different because it as we've mentioned, it's more about managing the short-term volatility between the assets and the liabilities. The rest of these models have long-term liabilities, long-term time horizons, and can tolerate more volatility in terms of the shorter-term volatility between the assets and the liability to achieve a longer-term goal. That would be the main distinction on that. So what corporate plans have done as a result of pension law that was passed in 2006 is, by and large, equity exposures have come down, fixed income exposures have gone up, and the fixed income exposure has extended its duration, which is a better match to the duration of the liabilities. Those that haven't done that have done so because they're underfunded. And so they still need to maybe have a higher risk posture to try to close the gap between their funding. Many corporations have made significant contributions. Many corporations have looked to make a risk transfer. As Alan said, they don't want to be in the pension business anymore. So just get this off my books. But that's required significant contributions to get to that point. There's also been some concern about interest rate levels, extending duration. If you think rates are going to go up, the timing might not be great. So a lot of corporations said, we're going to do this, but we're going to wait. Or we're going to do what's called LDI light, which is we might just do a little bit. And then if rates normalize, whatever that means, then they'll start extending the duration of the portfolio. So very different beast than the rest of these.
So, Jim, how do the low-cost plans deal with volatility? So, assuming they have the same, you know, liabilities out there, and if they are S&P tagged, there will be times when returns are negative. So, do you know what they do to smooth that? Is there an overlay that we're missing in a plan that is just equities based on the S&P?
No, just again, their observed volatility is likely going to be higher than those that have mm-hmm. alternative investments that don't have that same observed volatility. Mm-hmm. So that would be the distinction. Again, they may be using active management, they may be trying to diversify within their asset classes to address some of that volatility. Mm-hmm. But again, backing it up to the original question of, you know, when you look at just equity and fixed income exposure, it's probably not altogether that different. It's just how you're implementing that equity and fixed income exposure that's the main difference.
Mm-hmm. Are you asking how maybe that market value volatility impacts maybe downstream in terms of contribution rates that, you know, maybe fixed income and bond may have to go?
Sure. Obviously, if the volatility is reflected in a drawdown, then they're going to have to make that up through additional contributions. So that's something that they have to deal with. All of these are in different positions in terms of their funded status. I think, is IMRF funded? Is that what I mean? Municipal, right, Janet? What are, that's another Janet client, and we let her escape. I mean, so, but what are they? How
funded? IMRF is well, very yep. well funded. Yep. They're a municipal plan, yep. so if you don't pay, you get kicked out.
Yep.
So they don't have a problem that the other Illinois plans have. The state is primarily responsible for making the
I don't think I'm just eyeballing this list, and Alan, you may have some insights better than mine, but I'm just eyeballing it. I don't think any of the funds that were used to kind of represent this universe are grossly underfunded. They would all be around average.
Minnesota, they're okay, right? Minnesota's pretty low.
Yeah. Idaho is pretty well funded. Mississippi might be the lowest. I can't remember where they are. They might be the lowest of this. I want to say Mississippi's 65% funded, maybe. I don't know Oklahoma teachers at all. So certainly that's something that they have to deal with by having that model. And you know, the other element for public pensions is that, you know, it's not, once upon a time it was 60-40. You know, this was depicted the other day when we were looking at how things have changed over the last 20 years, right? In order to get a 8% return 20, 25 years ago, you know, 60-40 would get you there, and probably an excess.
60% bonds.
Well, yeah, right, but I mean the 60-40, the traditional 60-40 model for the long-term institutional investor easily met the objective.
Yeah.
Based on expectations now, it doesn't, so
no,
60-40 is now 80-20.
Yeah.
The other thing that your peers in the public sector have to deal with that the Canadians and the endowments don't is huge negative cash flow. And I was on a panel yesterday with my client, Cal Teachers, and they have $500 million a month going out the door net. So they have to work on that. They have to plan for negative cash flow, and they have a large real estate portfolio and a large private equity portfolio with unpredictable cash flow characteristics. So almost all of my clients are spending more time looking at managing cash flow than they are doing a lot of other things, which they didn't have to do before. The Canadians are still growing. The endowments have the ability to change liabilities. And it's only the DB model, and the DB model which wasn't well funded, that has this unique problem of having to get high returns and at the same time deal with significant negative cash flow.
Well, you know, that is an answer to a question for the other session. In thinking about an endowment that goes in perpetuity, why would you care about short-term losses? But it is mentioned, and I think that's a good example. There are cash flow issues. So the short-term volatility is an issue just for that.
And what most endowments have done is they've changed their way they make their gifting or their spending. And they're not making 10-year commitments and 15-year commitments. They're making 1-, 2-, and 3-year commitments. So they're forced to have a high level of liquidity to meet those obligations. And they also learn the terrible leverage, which all of us learned about leverage. And leverage is a two-edged sword. It works great when things are good, but boy, is it painful when it doesn't work. I have to tell you, John, that works.
Well, yeah, no, absolutely. But I wasn't thinking about endowment. I was thinking about your example of CalSTRS. They are worried about cash flow. So short term volatility does matter a lot.
It does, but the more time you spend thinking about managing cash flow, that allows you to make that a liquidity bet as long as you're prepared for that need. So most of my large clients, where 10 years ago, they would have said, we have zero allocation to cash. We're going to equitize 100% of any residual cash in a portfolio. There will be no cash. Any manager's cash will go to the derivatives market and get exposed. I now have clients who have 4% cash at all times. Okay, the lowest returning asset class. At all times, they have 4%. Because they can't predict whether the legislature is going to make a contribution, and they have big negative cash flows.
And I suppose if they did need to sell equities, they would be doing so when everybody else is selling equities.
And so what they've done is they've tiered their assets and said, in the event we blow through the 4%, here's the next pool of assets that we're going to go to. So they now have a treasury sleeve. Mm-hmm. And the treasury sleeve in that environment will generally be the one that's doing well. You're going to go there first. And then once you go, and the whole hierarchy of liquidity sources, so they don't have to sell long-term assets to meet short-term liabilities.
Yeah, the endowment model, a couple characteristics that I think are interesting there. That they, as Alan mentioned, that they have this ability where they can adjust their spending, but I think there's been a number of high-profile situations where they really can't. And so I think Princeton, for example, I think it's something like 55% of the university's operations come from the endowment. So, yeah, they can adjust it, but that has an enormous impact on the operations of the university. And others have maybe not that extreme. I know that one was put up there as a high situation. Others rely heavily on it, not just in terms of, you know, of granting of gifts and things of that nature, but the operations of the entity rely heavily on the endowment. So in that case, diversification, minimizing a drawdown has an enormous role. I think the other flip side of the U.S. endowment is it's a competition too. And we've always heard about that. They Yale envy, everyone chasing returns, and they compare themselves to each other frequently. They want to know, you know, what did Stanford do? What did Yale do? So it's very much of a competition to maximize return in many cases, or has been historically, and I don't think that that's the ultimate goal of a public pension plan.
These are guys, typically.
Come on, John, I compare myself to them too. And for the record, I'm just behind Yale.
In fact, that's not the case, and a lot of really good people have come out of Yale, and They're from all over the place, and men, women, and there are many, many women managing endowments. There are far more women managing endowments than there are other pension plans or corporate pension plans.
Yes. All right, quick question. So I think what I've heard, if I've heard this right, that our investment priority is based primarily on risk-adjusted returns. I'd like to confirm that or not, but there might be some other components that I'm missing. For example, are there problems that we're trying to solve beyond just trying to get risk-adjusted returns here? And two problems that I'm curious about are we faced with an actuarial problem or a cash flow problem or both? And do either of those or any other issues that we're faced with drive our investment philosophy?
Well, let me try, since I'm always willing to stick my foot in it. I don't believe that what drives the user is congested return. I believe what drives this fund is starts with how do we get the highest rate of return that comes close to whatever the actual rate is, and then diversify as well as you can while trying to get that rate. But it starts with searching for return, and then it's how do we diversify around getting that objective. That's my opinion. And then as a third level is how do we manage cash flow. For CIO, but that's how I see it. And I would think that's how most of my clients see it.
I'm still unclear, because what I heard you say in the end there was that we're still return is the most significant driver.
And you solve, you want to get a return plus or minus X. And let's use today in your environment 7.5%.
Yeah, and so I think you're both saying the same thing, because it's not optimizing the risk-adjusted return in an absolute sense. It's optimizing the risk-adjusted return relative to what you need to achieve. So if your objective is 7.2%, you want to optimize the risk-adjusted return that's going to get you 7.2%.
So would our philosophy be different? Well, I'm just going to... Okay.
I'm going to interject and add that there's, and I wish I had it memorized or I wish I had it in front of me, I think there's a really powerful single sentence in our policies about asset allocation that talks about, the supreme responsibility is balancing the risk of short-term drawdowns versus the long-term risk of not meeting pension obligations. And so that's not precise, but I think it's really accurate in characterizing the ultimate mission. And so I'm closer to the way Alan described it, is start with return, especially relative to the liabilities or what it takes to match those liabilities, but to a point. And you know, the challenge that we faced over the past few years is we're at that ceiling. It's like I described on Wednesday, we don't have another gear to go to because we're already at 80-20. And so you go past 80-20, and then I think we violate our responsibility vis-a-vis our short-term responsibilities against guarding against a drawdown that could permanently impair the fund. So it gets back to the observation, this used to be a lot easier job when you do 60-40 or even 70-30 and meet the assumed rate. But I'm certainly not comfortable going beyond where we are today at 80-20, because past 80-20 we hit an air pocket all at 08 or 09, or even half that size, then we run the risk of permanent impairment.
Yeah, and if I could add on to that, I think from my own perspective, and I sort of hesitate without actually having done the quantitative work, but my sense is that even at an 80-20, I fear that the 80-20 is too risky.
Well, I think, you know, when you look at the stuff that Carl shows you every quarter on the contributions to risk, I mean, the risk is coming from equity. The 60-40 didn't just materialize out of nowhere. It was a point on a efficient frontier that had an attractive risk-adjusted return. But so the 40% bonds was actually doing something to that portfolio. At 20% in bonds, that's a reasonable question. Is it, what is it? What are they really doing to the portfolio? It's a risky portfolio.
And I would say that certainly, at least over the past year, but the council has heard that almost every asset class team for, you know, public equity looking at low vault equity, fixed income looking for, you know, better way to build the portfolio. And you heard it on Wednesday with the alternatives portfolio. I think everyone's looking for ways to manage that equity risk, governed by the fact that we are targeting a 7.2% return. How else can we get more bang for the buck? And at least on the cash flow, cash management side as well, that's been an ongoing project. between the portfolio risk and research and the investment vision and operations to get a sense of what is our cash flow liquidity need and how do we manage a $300 million outflow every month. So certainly the staff is well aware of these risks and these issues.
Okay. No, I apologize if I led anyone to believe that I don't think staff is aware of the issues. I think staff is supremely aware of the issues. I guess the way I would put it is I worry a little bit that I'm not sure how to best put this, but I feel that there are numbers that are forcing us in a direction of investing that maybe isn't the right way to do it. So we have this mindset of 7.2. And again, that's based on our governance structure, that's a completely different board, and they need to come up with their own numbers and they have their own methodology. But is it our responsibility? I guess I'm asking to try to match that number from a portfolio construction perspective, or is our responsibility different than that? That's part of what I guess I'm trying to figure out a little bit.
I would say that it's not our responsibility. This is a conversation we had with Director Rodman. But I would also say, to me, I don't have that mindset. To me, it's almost a moot issue because we're at the top gear. This is as aggressive as a portfolio as I'm comfortable managing. I believe to a person, my staff feels the same way. So that 7.2 today is an artifact. It's not a goal, it's an artifact.
Right. I guess what I'm asking is, so why do we not consider going less risky?
Okay, having, I think, other than maybe Mike Mueller, I've probably been more of these meetings than anyone else in the room. That's the first time I've heard that question. And there was a board member for a number of years. He said, why aren't we much more risky? And he was very articulate and very thoughtful. And he said, we're making the most money in private equity. Let's put 50% of the portfolio. Now, he was joking, at least in part. But he said, we don't care about the liabilities.
Easier said when the interest rates were so high, right?
No, this was going in a relatively low interest rate environment. He believed that your role was just to maximize return.
He did not think you should look at risk.
That the actuaries would smooth the risk, that the legislature would make up contributions, and that you as an investment counsel shouldn't worry about that. And what you're doing, which I think is totally appropriate, is saying, I want to integrate risk and return, and what should we really be trying to attain? And that's, in my mind, if nothing else, then this is a success for this meeting, to raise that issue, because that is the issue. What are you chasing?
And I
completely agree. To remember Russell's point 2 days ago about the $22 billion unfunded liability, what I should have said is if $22 billion dropped out of the sky into my lap, we would de-risk the portfolio.
Right.
Well, and without regard to private equity versus public equity, I don't know how you square that with what we all know is 529 plans. If you put money into a 2-year-old's 529 plan for college in 16 years, it's all equity. And that's the conventional wisdom. So if we were following that model, would be all equity. And private equity versus public equity is a little different animal. But
John, your example is excellent. Because, in fact, there's nothing but positive cash flow in the 529 program for 18 years.
Right.
And so you can withstand the volatility because there's no need for a drawdown. And on every dip, if you're doing it on a monthly basis, you're buying cheap occasionally. And that works over very long periods of time. But when you have very negative cash flows and you're underfunded, you don't really have that. We talk about having a long-term horizon. That has to be blended with the practical realities of the cash flows and the other concerns you have as a public agency.
Can we talk about the rabbit, so to speak, that we're chasing? So when we changed the policy last year, John, we broke out Alpha and Beta. And we informed the PERS board that we thought 7.1 was the right beta number, and then we tacked on a bit more that we thought we could get because of some historic overperformance in certain asset classes. So in thinking about what we're reaching for and taking that risk for, I want to talk a little bit about that in the context of the change in thinking that we put into policy last year. So there are three distinct concepts here. There is the beta number that we've said in policy, there's the beta plus alpha number that we said in policy, and then there's the number that the PERS board set, which is 7.2. So when you think about trying to achieve the alpha and then the reasonable beta number, are you thinking of the larger risk number or just the 7.1 that is the number that we've put forth as a reasonable beta expectation for the portfolio? I know they're not materially different, but I want to make sure we understand what we've said to the PERS board and then the difference between those things and what they actually adopted in policy.
Well, I think it's very important to include the alpha element because I believe that that's an explicit expectation of this council on staff.
Okay, so council members, that number last year was 7.1 plus 40 basis points?
39.
Okay, so the number really is 7.5, which isn't that different, but again, as John has said, 40 basis points on $90 billion is a lot of risk, right? So we should understand what we've said to them in changing the policy and adding on alpha. Not only has the unfunded liability stretched them, but also our expectations about alpha on top of the market beta number, in essence, is what we're saying in policy.
So, Rekaya, this is the first time I've heard that add-on explained as risk. Is that the way you do it?
That's the way I view it. I mean, if I remember correctly, John, tell me if I'm right, the alpha contributions are private equity, real estate, and alts. Did I get that right?
This is where it gets a little bit confusing, is there are embedded alpha expectations in the private market asset classes, mm-hmm. private equity, real estate, alts, and opportunity. Those are in the 7.1.
Okay.
So the additional 40 basis points are the explicit outperformance expectations you all have of staff and staff in turn of managers in the public markets, public equity and fixed income. There aren't market benchmarks, investable benchmarks for private markets. Right? So we can't say to Mike Langdon, this benchmark plus. We model the portfolio, as Janet described on Wednesday, that takes into account our portfolio construction, our prowess, our experience, and it comes up with a net number. In private markets, that net number includes some element of alpha.
Okay.
The 40 basis points is unique to public markets. It's public market benchmark plus, or again, chinning the bar to the tune of 40 basis points.
Thank you for that clarification. So then I would say yes, John, to that question.
So on Wednesday, council approved the capital market assumptions, and it's actually a 30 basis points of
okay.
excess return target. Now, it does add incrementally more risk. So it has a different set of risks than if you just, for instance, public equity has a 50% excess return target with a active risk budget that the OIC approved back in November. So it does add risk, or it provides a tracking error, if you will, relative to the benchmark of the MSCI All Country World Index. But it's not necessarily, if you look at a total risk level, like this might get too technical, but it's not necessarily that much more risky than just a benchmark. It's just there is a tracking error now, and that is adding some active risk to the total plan.
John, does that make sense? What he's saying is, in order to get that extra 30 basis points, we give them more wiggle room around the benchmark. And that additional wiggle doesn't materially, it increases it, but not materially, the total risk budget. Does that make sense?
Yep, the budget's 60-40, yeah.
So, yes, more risk, but Carl is saying he thinks that they can take it without materially changing the risk we're already taking. Right. So in essence, we said to the staff, we want more return, but we don't want you to take more risk. You can wiggle a little more, but in the end, we want you to get to the same place.
But there's another level of risk. And that is, since you look at things on a relative basis, you have 100% certainty your beta is going to be achieved through your exposure to indices. The active management component is a complete unknown. Mm-hmm. There is no evidence that anyone consistently can create alpha. And my history of 35 years in this business in a highly diversified portfolio, a 40 basis point premium over the public markets is extremely hard to attain.
So you're saying it's like a three sigma event?
No, and I think there are periods when you all have done that with good manager selection and some good tactical moves, but you can't predict that. You can't bank on that. Because there will be periods where it just won't happen, no matter how smart you are.
It could also be negative.
Right.
But it goes on both sides of the curve.
So say that to us in terms of the expectation we've set for the 30 basis points. I think I hear you saying you're at 7.1, there's a 50-50 chance you'll get there, which is the number I think Janet gave us. And it's really unclear that you'll get that extra alpha that you set out in policy. So what the heck are you doing?
It's not what I think you and your staff have said. We need to try to make that increment help improve the financial condition of the plan. And a lot of people have made a similar decision. I don't take exception to that. You just can't bank on it. It's an unknown. And the plan, assuming that that will occur, I think that's, you know, very optimistic.
I mean, I think it's along the same lines where I worry about, again, this hopeful expected excess return at the portfolio level, but also at the individual asset class levels as well, where we're benchmarking, for example, private equity against the public market plus 300, or why do we have 300? Where does it come from? Why is that more correct than any other number? So on and so forth. And I think I made this comment at the last meeting, which is I fear that we're allowing these not completely, but somewhat arbitrary numbers at times that can be hard to achieve to dictate how we invest. And I would like to see a little bit more of a examination or a re-examination of that belief.
Rex, I've always assumed that 300 basis points is a measure of the risk that we're prepared to take. If the difference was any lower, we wouldn't be in that field.
So, yes, I agree with you in principle. I think there's two different ways to look at it, though. You can say, well, we need the extra return, or you could model it with a higher level of risk. The reality, though, I think, is that by putting it into the return number, we're setting expectations, again, the sort of feedback loop across our system, whether it be with the PERS board and so on, of these objectives that maybe aren't even attainable, right? So instead of adding it to the return expectation, we could add it to the risk number, right? I mean, the reality is everyone wants to get compensated for this illiquidity risk. Well, I don't know what the amount of return premium should be for the amount of illiquidity.
For the increment of risk.
Right. So I think you can adjust it vis-a-vis the risk number, the standard deviation number, not necessarily the expected return number. We sort of did both. We raised the expected return and lowered the risk.
So I would say
I might be thinking about it wrong. So if someone disagrees, please.
No, I mean I don't think you're wrong at all. I think that was the one of the main driver why we separated out the alpha and the beta, if you will, last year. And I believe, and unfortunately, Director Roman is not here, but I believe the PERS board took the 7.1% policy return as an input into their calculation of how to adjust their assumed rate of return, and they did not consider this excess return target that obviously, you know, some staff are working towards. So I think they focus just on the policy return, and the excess return target are essentially incremental moves that the council has approved to try to pick up a little bit more return if possible.
Yeah, and from the PERS board perspective, my understanding is that they don't take our number and use it. I think Milliman's number was 6.8. So, and they somehow came up with 7.2.
7.2, so I was in that meeting. They looked at five different numbers. PCA, Callan, Milliman,
and BlackRock.
BlackRock, and there might have, yeah, one more. And
they came up with a 7.2 that was higher than any other.
It was a compromise of what the board members thought. So what 7.2 wasn't any of the numbers.
Yep.
So what the PERS board takes and what we drive our portfolio on, I think, gets at your question. And what I'm hearing is maybe a conversation about expected return or allocating risk between the asset classes, not allocating numeric return, is what I'm hearing you say you want us to start to think about.
Can you restate that? Sure.
So if the S&P 500 plus 300 is a somewhat arbitrary calibration of risk contribution, I think I hear you saying, well, why don't we think about divvying up risk between the asset classes rather than setting targets for expected return, so benchmarks based on expected return. Is that where you were heading with Rex?
I think at a basic level, for us to try to come up with excess return numbers is really difficult.
So you're saying do it according to risk, like the risk budget. Is that what you do and we just don't see it, John? Is that what's happening?
Well, there's no easy way out because the risk part is arbitrary too. If you recall from Jan's presentation on Wednesday, I realized volatility in private equity is 12-13%. And their pro forma projection is in the 30s. And so we split the difference for modeling purposes. But to me, that's no less or no more arbitrary than coming at it from the return side.
Well, if I may, I'd like to get back to the benchmark issue because they do serve a very useful function for me in determining whether we should be in that class at all. If we set a benchmark and we're not achieving it, then it says to me that we should exit that class. So that's the value of it for me.
Well, I would argue strenuously against that one, Member Russell, because there's ebbs and flows. So in your inbox is a report, which you may have already read, from Mike Viteri on public equity, the quarterly update. You can see in there we have met the excess return objective over 1, 3, 5, 7, 10 years. I fully expect that a report from Michael Langan 10 years ago would have said the same thing, and I fully expect a report from Mike Langan sometime in the future will say the same thing. So there are macro forces, primarily monetary policy, that we don't control that affect these spreads to a huge degree, much more so than staff ever could through security selection or manager selection. So we have to always come back to what is our single most potent strategic advantage. And I would argue that as we measure our investment horizon in decades, and if we remain committed to that, then we will not be distracted by positive or negative performance versus the benchmark and shorter term horizons. And then
I wasn't advocating a hair trigger deal, John, but I think they still serve that function in my mind. And I think what you're saying is you just can't evaluate that quarter by quarter, year by year, 3 years, or whatever. But I still think that has
Well, let's say we go through a protracted period of private equity performance that is not Russell 3000 plus 300, but it's Russell 3000 plus 200. Is that a failure?
I don't think any of us are saying that.
Russell 3000 plus 200 is $300 million a year.
Right. I think what I hear from John is that the benchmark serves as a opportunity for discussion and understanding, not necessarily, dramatic decision making.
And as a measure, I've always viewed it as a measure of de facto risk.
Well, again, in private markets, the risk is just as challenging because we know what it is with precision and hindsight. Again, we have every single year realized much less risk in our private market activities than any of us expected. So in this challenging exercise of projecting, we always want to err on the conservative side, but to the point Alan made couple days ago, we've got a perfect record of missing, but in this case, we've always been too conservative.
So, John, then what would be the measure by which we could, what would we focus on to help us think about whether or not the asset classes or the asset allocation model needed further thought, if not the benchmarks? So what other tool is there for a board?
Well, I think it's, the quarterly report that we do with Cal and with Carl is really important in terms of understanding what the pulse is, complemented with the annual reviews from the asset classes to understand the dynamics in portfolio construction. Because, to the point about asset allocation being the driver, at the asset class level, portfolio construction is the driver. So if we were to wake up 10 years down the road and be disappointed, the disappointment is going to come from something that we missed in portfolio construction. You know, we went over the top in venture capital, or we didn't do enough venture capital. Those are the discussions that I think are the most important for the council, because the report, there's the amount of money in private equity, the amount of money we put in LBOs versus venture capital versus growth, is going to determine long term where we are on that spread. And any snapshot in time is going to be useful, but it shouldn't drive the strategic decisions that you all are charged to make.
And just to take that back to what we started at, that's true for every one of those models. And balancing the risk and return and what your objective are, I don't care which one of the corporate or endowments or Canadian, everyone's doing it. They're just doing it in a different construct because they have a different set of liabilities. They have different principles. They have different political pressures. And you don't work in a vacuum. I mean, if you decide to take the low-risk thing, let's just go to Treasury bonds. And that's legitimate. Corporate America made that decision. Well, what did it do? Okay, you have an expected return of the portfolio of 3.4%. You've just doubled your unfunded liability. It's a great investment decision. It's a brave one. But it's unimplementable. It's not practical. And you have to live within the world and the tools that you have available to you. If you want to get your direct investment, given what you pay, you're not going to get the people who are going to leave Goldman Sachs to do transactions for you at $300,000 a year. It's just not going to happen. They want $3 or $4 or $5 million, and then they want a bonus. Are you going to be able to get them? The answer is no. So you have to live, and maybe you have to outsource that. So that's why you hire managers who have that skill set. And it's up to your team to find the best people and recognize that they're really expensive. But everyone out there in every one of those models is competing with you for return. And the key is how do you get your fair share of it within the risk budget that you can live with. And that's what's important to remember. You're not in a vacuum. Yes, CalPERS and CalSTRS in Washington are your peers. They're competing for exactly the same returns that you are. And you're only friends until you're on the opposite sides of the table. That was my latest.
Any other questions for the team on this topic? Thank you. We'll take a 15-minute break. I'll see you back at 2:20. I like that conclusion. At a high level, I've been trying to get... Okay, fellas, let's get started. Okay, let's get started.
You want to do an intro or should I just go to
I know better than to think I can introduce you.
Good response.
Okay. For the record, Alan Emkin, PCA. 5 years ago, the board adopted a set of investment rules. Since then, lots have changed. The capital markets have changed. The board is almost completely changed. There is a completely different staff, in large part. And on top of that, there are different assets. There are a whole group of different skills on the staff. And there's a whole group of different tools that they use to help you do your jobs. And so the decision was made that we should revisit those investment beliefs. It's important to recognize the investment beliefs are the foundation. They're the macro guidelines, the roadmap to manage the investment portfolio. And they are an excellent reference and a point of departure as you make investment decisions. Are your investment decisions consistent and driven by what you as a board believe in? And what's important to keep in mind is these are not tactical beliefs. These are strategic beliefs. They're designed and intended to be long-standing and not to be tinkered with. But that doesn't mean you don't look at them on a regular basis and make sure that they're still applicable. And this is an opportunity for you to undertake that kind of review. We means myself and my associate Brandon Ross, who did the heavy lifting, worked on these beliefs and created a document with the input of you and a large number of people on your staff. 14 people were surveyed. There were lots of comments. And the result is this red line version, which, with your permission, I'm going to go through. But I want you to please don't feel we have to finish this document today, because there are a couple of items that if you, in quote, get stuck on for 15 or 20 minutes or for an hour, would be a good use of your time. And if not, that's great. And if we can complete the process today, that's wonderful. But I don't feel, as your consultant who undertook this study, any need to see you take action today. So I just want to put that as a point of reference. So in front of you, maybe you go to... is a red line version of your investment beliefs. And there are footnotes. And the footnotes, with one exception, give you the rationale or the thinking that goes into why we have either put it in, taken it out, or just brought it to your attention. So the first one is under investment belief one, there's a new A. And the new A reflects a lot of input, primarily from your staff, that your beliefs should be driven more by data analysis and science than by mystery and art. And we completely support that. That really, until the 1980s, the investment management industry was cloaked in secrecy. No one knew what the heck anyone was doing. The custodians didn't know. Large banks and trust companies controlled, and insurance companies controlled the assets, and they gave their clients one-line reports. Now you have fundamental characteristics on individual securities in your portfolio. It's a different world. And that data and the tools that come out of things like your risk management system give you a much better handle on what's going on in the portfolio and what its implications or ramifications are, and that's why that is included.
Alan, if I may.
Sure.
There's something missing, that category missing, and that is I'm not sure we are completely aware of the wishes of our beneficiaries. This is an extreme example. If we had a choice of a high return for the mafia and a low return for the Vatican, science would say, put it all with the mafia. Now this, it gets into the ESG primarily, but I do think we need to have a little bit of humility about what our beneficiaries would like, would expect us to do. I don't know, where does that fit? Is that art or science or what?
Very rarely do I defer to counsel. but in fact, you have a legislative mandate, and I would argue that you're governed by that legislative mandate, in my recollection, rightfully or wrongfully, if it doesn't reference the wishes of the beneficiaries. Now, I could be wrong on that. But if I'm right, then I don't think you have the legal authority to do that. That doesn't mean there are issues that you couldn't consider that could affect the investment portfolio. But I think, you know, I would defer to a former legislator and to counsel on what you can and cannot use in terms of your investment beliefs.
Well, I would also defer to counsel in terms of the legality, but I would say what I often think about, to use the scenario you set up, is that there are plenty of times when our values and our interests are not inconsistent with delivering returns to beneficiaries. So I think you could argue that the mafia probably faces different regulatory risks, and that they might have a different reason we wouldn't want it to go entirely that direction. I think Mr. Emkin's right. There's not a specific reference to accommodating wishes beyond the acknowledged wish to have sustainable and a secure retirement.
And to the extent that those sorts of issues have an impact on portfolio risk and return, they should be considered.
Right.
But, you know, if I was a public employee and I said, you know what, I really want to retire, and the best way to do that is to have the highest rate of return, so let's put it all in private equity. That might be a legitimate wish, but it may not be a prudent thing to do. So it's a balancing act.
Mr. Marlowe, will you...
Yes.
Welcome to the meeting.
Yes. Thank you.
Yeah,
it's refreshing since I carry these statues with me all the time to actually get to use them occasionally. So, but Alan's right on. So there is statutory language which, you know, has guardrails as to our decisions here on the board. So just to quote, so the general objective of the investments here from our statutes is, and I guess that's why Steve Carlson, if he were here, he would say the prime directive is to earn returns. Statutory, it says to make monies as productive as possible. The sentence goes on, subject to the standards set forth in the 7.726. Buried in 7.26 then does speak about considering the investment of those funds under the circumstances and prevailing distribution requirements. So, now I believe there is a wealth of guidance that we have that speaks about, so prime directive, earned returns. I guess I'm trying to now summarize. So, but one of the considerations in our statutes, distribution requirements. So, now, I'm really trying to summarize. I believe there's a lengthy amount of guidance that this office of DOJ has already put out. I think it's encapsulated in your policies already. So it, I guess in two sentences, prime directive, earn returns, there is a consideration, though, of how much is distribution.
So, John, then that prime directive plus a focus on cash flow, I think I hear, there is the sort of ambiguous area of constituent relations or other things that might be a part of the treasurer's mandate in representing the people, but in statute, this board's responsibility is not that.
Okay, understood.
So then that makes me circle back to clarifying with John Sherbum that our values and beliefs are not policy. So they're more like a Bible and less like a constitution, right?
I go more like the Ten Commandments.
Ten Commandments. Okay, all right, Ten Commandments.
But my religious history.
Okay. Okay, so these aren't policies that are adopted. They are a set of agreements between the board and staff. So we compile these values and beliefs together. So is that the right way to think about?
In my opinion, they're your beliefs. They're not the staff's beliefs. The staff gives you input, but you are the policymakers. You are the ultimate fiduciary, and it's very important never to forget that. And only to the extent that you choose to delegate to the staff do they have that responsibility.
So then this first item 1A, you said, is the largest staff-driven suggested addition to the values and beliefs.
Right. Oh, yeah, there's no question where that came from. I don't think it's terribly controversial. I think, in fact, that's just best practices, is that you should be using as much good information and current theory as is available in the deliberations and decision-making of this council.
Well, the first bullet, well, not to kind of wordsmith, but I think the statements about overstated or inflated, I don't, that doesn't sound boardy to me, but I think I understand the idea, which is that we want to be as empirical as possible in our decision making.
These are your beliefs, and this is intended to raise discussion, and getting that kind of input, we take that and we make this better.
Okay.
This isn't an end product. This is, and it's so important for me to underscore, this is your document. It's not PCA's document, it's not the staff's document. You're the only ones that have been appointed to the council.
Okay,
the one that I'm going to urge you to focus on, the one that we might spend the next hour on, is number one, subsection B, one word, largely. And the input and the discussion should be, there is a suggestion that the word largely, which is the existing language, be deleted. Now, we didn't take a position on that. That was input that we received. So effectively, saying that the council delegates to the staff implementation. And that's been skirted around and discussed directly and indirectly, but I urge you to at least have a conversation on the efficacy, the pros and the cons, of delegating more or less than you currently do. It's in your court now, Madam Chair.
I'm not a lawyer.
I don't think this is a legal issue.
No, it's not.
Yeah.
I'll ask a question. So, to me, this has to do with governance overall and the purpose that the board exists. And so how much responsibility and engagement should we have in the investment activities? And that takes us down the path of what does our agenda reflect in our board meetings? Are we spending most of our time? And I'm not suggesting there's a right or wrong, but no one else had a question, so I'm asking it. But I think it's important. And this has to do with things like committee authority to make investment decisions, those kind of things. And I'm not sure what is right. Our governance does feel a bit awkward to me for a few reasons. First, it seems to me like we should probably spend more time talking about strategy and portfolio construction, I guess, than the investment decisions that are made. Just me personally, given my history and experience, and I've said this before, realizing the quality of the team, the staff that's here, the amount of due diligence that's done, the work that complements that with our consultants. And then coming in at the tail end of many months or a year's worth of work and in a 1-hour meeting trying to second guess the decision that is brought to the committee is really difficult. And then, you know, my experience so far, although that I think, you know, history has been different at times, to take those investment decisions and put them in front of the council for a meeting after all that work has been done, and for us to spend the amount of time that we do to kind of bless those decisions, the investment decisions. Is that what we're really here to do primarily? Or are we here in a more formal board, a purpose or arrangement to speak more about issues like governance, organization structure? Should we spend more time talking about, and by the way, when I say this, I say it with all due respect because you are a terrific leader. The best leader that we, you know, so
I know, Rick. Come on, let's go. So
we all know that. But I'm just being cautious, right? Because I want to be understood the right way and not misunderstood. I'm just asking questions. But should we spend more time on asking ourselves, is the governance structure right? Do we have the right budget authority, HR authority? Do our agendas reflect more high-level strategy, thinking about, bantering about long-term investment themes and opportunities that, you know, based on demographic trends, global trends, global warming, those kind of things that create investment opportunities over the long term for us? Just me personally, I think we could probably be more of a value add with those kind of discussions than as much or more engagement in the transactional decisions that I see us engaged in today. That's just my perspective, my question. I think it relates to this word. And so I just raise that to the council.
So if I can ask a follow-on question from everything you said, Rick, is asset allocation, portfolio construction, policy setting, or investments related? And anyone?
In my opinion, that's policy. So the thematic ideas should be looking at aging issues and how might that be reflected in the portfolio. If there is an issue with climate change and how that might affect coastal properties, that's a discussion that's a macro issue. It's not a micro issue, in my opinion. Picking an individual manager, whether it's a public or private manager, doesn't make any difference. Mm-hmm. I like the term transactional. That's just making an individual buyer-sell decision. Mm-hmm. I like that distinction.
So there's a lot in that word activities, as well as largely. Those seem to be the two decision points.
So I would echo a lot of what Rick in his question raised. I do think that we do spend a lot of time on individual transactions. I, for one, do not see as much value in having an investment manager come before us for 45 minutes. I would personally like for us to spend time with managers when the manager is representing a large source of work. For example, I would love to see some of our higher allocation to see the managers where we have more dollars invested with them come speak with us, because I see that as a source of fiduciary responsibility to make sure we understand our largest sources of risk. The individual ideas that come to the table, I don't find it as useful. What I find useful is listening to the staff talk about how they got to the conclusion and why they're excited about said manager or opportunity set. In regards to 1B, I think what is missing from there is an outline or a better understanding of what policy is. To sort of enshrine the idea that we believe asset allocation is a policy setting discussion. If we can, I hesitate to go down that route because all of a sudden it could become an exhaustive list, and I don't want it to become an exhaustive list. But I'm not sure everyone would necessarily think asset allocation is necessarily a policy discussion. I see it as a policy discussion, but I'm not sure that others would. I think others could see it as a investment activity rather than a policy discussion.
So this conversation is really interesting, especially with a new board. So for three consecutive legislative sessions, we made an attempt to change the governance model to reflect exactly your concerns, and that was not supported by the legislature, questionably supported by the governor and by the staff, frankly. So the conversation about how we govern ourselves is one that we will have to keep having and hopefully get to a point where we can agree on it. But if we are in this system, then I think we sort of have to figure out what our Ten Commandments are in that process. This is the first legislative session since I've been on the board that we have not made an attempt to lift out, right? At least since I've been on the board.
I was only going to add to that, it's 100% correct. The upside of that was that we did get a lot of positions that we needed.
Yeah, the outcome of those attempts were the staffing support, the additional funding for Aladdin, and a lot of the growth that you've seen. But we've had this conversation pretty much for 10 years now. And I would say the overall feeling from those attempts is a little bit of exhaustion around it, and that adhering to what we've said in the policies and in our values and beliefs was our attempt to try to just move forward given the construct that we have. And with that, I think a little bit more clarity on activities is good, but this is the same conversation we were just having with John about benchmarks. That S&P 500 plus 300 question, in essence, is asking, where is the, what's an investment management activity, what is a policy activity? So we're circling around.
That's definitely a policy issue. Setting benchmarks is definitely policy. That's not transactional.
So now what Rex is saying is, we want to itemize what those policy things are, I think I hear, or have some kind of outline of that versus management to sort of clarify that a little bit.
Yeah, again, I don't know if itemizing is necessarily the right path, although that is definitely a path. I fear going down the path of itemizing, all of a sudden we have a long list, and I'm not sure that's necessarily productive either. But yeah, some sort of language that specifies in a little bit more detail what policy is for future generations who are reading this and saying, well, what is the distinction?
Mm-hmm. I think we can come up with something and let you bang it out and see if it addresses it. And what will probably be is that here's some examples of policy that's included to be inclusive and not exclusive. You can't always think about every eventuality.
Let me respond to your question in another way. I think there's another risk that we haven't talked about, and that is we're talking about huge sums of money in the hands of relatively few people, and thus far there's been no evidence of any problems. But I think one of the reasons for that is that this is the body where all those decisions meet the light of day. Sun shines on it. And to the extent we want to keep it squeaky clean, we need to exercise that authority and recognize that we're the place where the public, in a sense, has access to these decisions. Now, you can do it in a consent calendar if you want, but I think we serve a risk reduction role. I sat on the State's Transportation Commission for 8 years. The staff had the authority to accept a little bid, but they did not have the authority to accept a bid where it was design-build, where there was a lot of subjectivity, and we're talking, hundreds of millions of dollars. That had to come in front of the Transportation Commission. And there was no evidence of any problems, but I think it largely because it did have to come into the light of day. So that to me is one of the major functions that we've not talked about, but I think it's real.
I understand all of that. I'm not sure there's a right answer or a wrong answer here, but I'm glad that we can bring these things and talk about it. And I do believe that just because we've talked about these things in the past, if it has not gone a certain way, if we believe strongly that there's a better governance or a better way to do it, it's our responsibility to continue to ask the question. And that's all I'm trying to do.
I like it.
Okay, carry on.
Not quite an hour.
I can't say that I'm disappointed. The next one should be easy. Same sections, subsection D, adding the term long-term and changing the word must to should. I don't think those are terribly substantive, but those were suggestions that we tried to incorporate. And Madam Chair, with your permission, unless I hear something from the Council, I'll just keep going. The next one is the OIC should generally prepare for the accepted periods of price. To me, that's just wordsmithing. It doesn't really have an awful lot of substance. It just lends some, ambiance or something. it's a good word. I don't use it very often. Next one's really important, which is sub-bullet E, and that's the fifth footnote. And it basically reflects that the council really doesn't have control over compensation. That's really up to the treasurer.
So then, I guess the rub here, again, with another one of the staff-driven bullets is, if this is about investing, why are we commenting on, why would staff incentives, or whether we control it or not, rise to the level of Ten Commandments in investment policy related?
Well, I think this one, the staff is saying it shouldn't. And I think that's pretty much, it's saying take that out because that's the current language, because that in fact is, you do not have the control over the compensation.
Okay.
I think it's important to stay in because we're the body that sets the benchmarks. And I go back to your Cowboys at Harvard kind of a thing. The board was remiss in permitting that compensation system because there wasn't an alignment of interest, clearly. If we didn't set benchmarks, it's a whole different story, but we do.
No, if the staff incentives are not tied to those benchmarks, it's a whole different story.
And
right, because we need the benchmarks.
Clear, the council has no decision-making rights at all. So whether or not the treasurer's compensation policy is tied to the benchmarks that you established.
Are they?
It varies. We use peer rankings for some, which is not the benchmarks you set for performance. So it's very good. You have benchmark performance as part of it. It's a complicated policy, and it's way more complicated than this for your benchmark setting. But just to be clear, they're very different. And the council has never opined on the treasurer's compensation policy, nor the end, nor the incentive portion of it.
I don't think anybody's disagreeing with that. I'm just saying that when we are setting benchmarks, it makes a big difference to me if that's part of the compensation system. We just need to be aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
The challenge, and Ms. Russell, I think I couldn't agree with you more. The question is whether it's, to me, is whether that should be part of your investment beliefs or some other relationship with the treasurer's office. So there's a level of communication between the treasurer's office and the council on how they're measuring performance and how they're compensating people,
right,
not necessarily in the investment beliefs. So just, we don't have to address it right now, but so the recommendation is to delete that language. Next.
So, Treasurer Reed, I assume at some point your point of view.
Yeah, I'm intentionally sort of staying out of that for obvious reasons, but I would suggest it is note the first bullet is interesting to say. It should be about things that staff members have clear authority and control, and yet at the same time we're now identifying that the council itself does not have control over that, and so that seems to be an interesting contrast, but. But this should be something I think I should not have too strong an individual opinion about. I can't imagine a scenario where I would want to have incentives that are at odds with performance and what happens in the council. I think as Deputy Treasurer indicated, there are other factors too, so it can't be exclusively one factor. I think I would always want to keep that in mind and consider that and be part of it, but I can be sensitive to the fact that there are other factors as well.
Well, I mean, if the issue there is not having the board think it's mucking around in compensation or any of the decisions the treasurer makes about staffing, then point F also then gets us into that discussion, which is, okay, you don't want us mucking around in your performance assessment, then we're also not mucking around in resource allocations, which even if they're funded by the fund, they're approved by the legislature. So I think the lens of which of these beliefs are really treasurer-driven activities, we might need to look through it and think about that as well. Right? Because we're not responsible for the resource allocation work, right? Where mm-hmm. you go before the legislature with John and the staff.
Mm-hmm.
And generally, has the board been involved in that process?
Not in my brief time, but...
Prior chairs were very involved in that
okay.
process.
But were they involved because of the conversation about the lift out? Like before we got into the lift out discussion?
Madam Chair, you know, we've had council members come before legislative budget committees to advocate for staff in the past. Sometimes it's to protect against budget cuts. But you know, this idea of advocating for adequate resources is longstanding with the council.
Okay, so you want us to advocate for resources but not be involved in...
That's different than, you know, just looking into and approving resource, you know, workload allocation within the treasurer's. You know, that's clearly a statute, you know, under the treasurer's administration for people in this relationship with treasurer as the investment officer or council.
So, Treasurer Reed, will you read through these and
yeah.
think about these activities? I think there's a little bit of awkwardness there, right? Which is to say the board advocates for resources and we make policy decisions that might impact individual performance incentives, but we shouldn't be involved in that. So I think there's a little thinking in there
okay.
to be done, and I'll defer to whatever you think is right.
But I do think we need some guidance about how to avoid the Harvard Cowboy thing. Because is that an investment belief? Yeah, you bet it is.
In my opinion, Mr. Russell, assuming that more is delegated, what it does, it increases the responsibility of your risk management people and your external consultants to be monitoring the portfolio to bring issues to your attention where they believe they deserve to be addressed. And I think at the margin, it might change some of those relationships because the consultants would have to become much more the board's consultants as opposed to the fund's consultants. And I draw a distinction there. And that's one that's worthy having a conversation because I have clients where the board has their consultants and the staff has their own consultants. Now, you could argue that I'm pushing for more consultants, which I'm not sure is a really good idea. But conceptually, the consultants work for you. And you don't see an awful lot of where the consultants and the staff disagree, even though they do. You don't see it. Because those issues generally get resolved, otherwise they wouldn't get before you. But you might be better off hearing about, well, we made this decision, but here's the debates that took place. Well, we decided to do X, Y, Z. We decided to do core real estate versus entrepreneurial real estate. We decided to do that. Now, that decision, first of all, is a policy decision. That is a policy decision. Then it goes down to how is it implemented? The consultant should be telling you that, in fact, your desires for the real estate portfolio to look a certain way is being accomplished. And if they do that independently, that's a little bit different than the traditional role that's been played here. It's a good discussion to have.
Well, I think Darren's correct in that the wording on E oversteps our bounds. It gets into how people are compensated. But I don't want to lose the Harvard Cowboy. How to avoid that? Because what we do is affected to some degree by compensation. We just need to be aware of it.
And I think we can work on language that really tries to hone in on that very issue.
Great.
Mm-hmm. Chair Adams, I really, the word you used, awkward, is how I feel a bit. And that's why I'm enjoying this meeting so much, because I think this really is, we're talking about strategy here and governance. the awkwardness that I feel is when we talk about our primary purpose of serving on this council, if it is transactional in nature, yet if I'm being asked to do a significant amount of due diligence on the transactions that are being made by our staff without any budget authority, without any HR authority, that's really awkward. Because that puts me into a position as a council member, I'm going to demand more staff and more consultants. Because as a council member, I can tell you, these numbers are big, hundreds of millions or billions. This is just it's a crux of how I feel awkward. Okay, not good or bad, but just awkward. And I just wonder if that's long-term where we feel our best value add is as members. Because I still question that. It's more than awkward. I think it's opportunistic. Because it doesn't fit. It's worked. But that's important to counter. Does that make sense to anybody else?
That's exactly how we all feel.
Okay. And that's what we've signed up for. But I also believe that what we signed up for is to constantly search for better ways to get the job done, to reduce risk, and to better ensure a positive outcome for the people that we represent, whose money we're investing. And I just don't think the current structure is set up to best do that. So I like that's you hit it right on the nail for me. It feels awkward, which means there's probably opportunity then.
So it sounds like you volunteered to lead us in thinking about the governance model. We had John volunteer last meeting to think about how our committee structure can be adjusted given the organization that we have now, but advancing the work that we did in the lift out was a whole other committee, so to speak, right, John, when we came on. And we could use some big brain thinking on that.
I'm not sure I've got a big enough brain for that. but
okay, sounds like you signed up for it. That sounds good. So then Treasurer Reed will be looking for some leadership from you on some of these bullets that are some gray area.
Yep.
Okay. So then, Alan, that keeping us moving along.
I'm going to move right along. Highly motivated. next page, number 2B, second bullet. And I refer you to the footnote for number 7. And we would suggest that footnote be made permanent. That's not just there for color, which many of the others are, to give you the thinking that went into it. But it just makes clear that risk, the way traditional financial analysts look at it, tends to be rather narrow. And we've learned by experience that other risks can have a meaningful impact upon the risk return of the portfolio. Anything from BP not having a good environmental record to bad employee relationships having an adverse impact on the bottom line, to having poor corporate governance not benefiting the shareholders but benefiting management or the board. And so, at the same time, that whole area is rapidly expanding. There are tools that are available today looking at those risks that were never available before. And this would basically enhance the current policy to say that those evolving risks should be managed and addressed.
Can you put that approach to this question in context relative to how other states and other clients have articulated that or handled it?
Language varies, yeah. But in terms of implementation, the most frequent way that these policies are implemented is twofold. First, through corporate governance, voting your proxies. Sometimes that's being part of organizations like the Council of Institutional Investors or other groups on whatever the issue might be that have collective opinions on a group of policy issues. And being part of those organizations and then having those issues reflected in your voting of proxies. How active you want to be, I have clients who are completely inactive and I have clients who have staffs of tens of people who do nothing but corporate governance. That's a decision I would personally prefer to avoid. But the big way is through voting your proxies and being part of organizations that share your concerns.
And in terms of how people articulate in their beliefs, where does this sit, do you think?
Sort of in the middle.
Okay.
It's definitely not what I would call one of the more aggressive policies, but others just say you should consider these things and put a period at the end of it with no clarification.
Okay. Thanks.
And the key is you've identified an issue, a risk, and an opportunity. That's what the belief is. Implementation is a separate issue which really shouldn't be reflected in a belief statement. It's right. A lower level.
Right. Thank you. That's helpful.
Good. Great. The next one, number four. This is the other one I think that is worth some consideration. And that there is existing language that talks about an illiquidity premium.
And inefficiencies.
And there is a legitimate debate in many places. To the extent that there is excess return, and I'm not calling it a premium, I'm just calling it excess return, versus public markets and private markets, where does it come from? Does it come from leverage? Does it come from value added? Does it come from illiquidity? And there is, in fact, an academic debate going on that would say there is no illiquidity premium. But there are strong advocates that believe there are, mainly practitioners. And so the goal here is to reword that in a way that diminishes removes the importance of illiquidity.
I would also like to see the word, the two words inefficiencies exist. I'm not sure if inefficiencies is the right phrasing to me, and I don't think it exists necessarily. It makes it sound like it does exist. I guess to me, private equity is more about a strategy in which managers have a toolkit that is different. For example, they are more control-oriented investors who have tools in their toolkit that are different from public investors, especially highly diversified portfolio investors. So it's not a excess return because of inefficiencies. To me, it's just a return stream that is different than public markets. I don't really like the expectation that there should be a illiquidity premium because I'm not sure I necessarily believe that it necessarily exists.
Well, we would share your belief about illiquidity. I don't want to wordsmith it in a committee, but if we put the word may in front of exist, I think we might address part of that issue. Because that makes it conditional. And I think we could enhance it by coming up with a sentence or two reflecting your concern about really having a different risk premium, which is really what you're saying, Rex.
Yeah.
And I think that's something we can work on and come back to you with.
I think the rub here for me too, Ellen, in thinking this through, on the one hand we say that empirical information is important in managing the fund, So if empirical information is beginning to challenge some of these concepts of inefficiency and illiquidity, then I think we have to get comfortable.
What you're doing, Madam Chair, what you've just done is that these should be internally consistent.
Right. So if, you know, I don't know that we need to say those things at all, right? So maybe the just the A bullet there, the A letter, and just get out of it.
I think that saying that it's a different risk premium, we can come up with something without getting into the specifics of why, and hopefully that will address the concerns that both the staff and the board have raised.
Sounds good.
Okay, the next one, which
okay.
are...
Hey, Alan, could
yes,
I just... I apologize for interrupting you.
No.
When it's written as private markets, what is that referring to? Is it broadly?
Indeed, that's across the board. That's all inclusive. That's not
real estate.
That's across the
real
board.
Real assets, so on.
And the difference there is that public markets trade, and you have pricing that's publicly available,
yep.
and there's a level of transparency, as opposed to private markets where those characteristics don't exist.
Perfect. Thank you.
Okay, going on to 4 sub B. There was an observation, the current language talks about top quartile. You had a recent review. You were not all top quartile, so there was a desire to eliminate that. And then there were other types of diversification, and it was felt that it would be good to broaden how to diversify. I have no problem. As a matter of fact, I think broadening the diversification requirements is good. And you don't need top quartile in this one to make the point, in my opinion.
So to navigate, the suggestion is to eliminate top quartile, manager selection, and the other red are additions.
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you.
And I might endorse that. I think top quartile is inherently backwards looking, and you could have a top quartile fund that we believe was aging. And if that word is in there, that wording is in there, we wouldn't be allowed to invest in somebody that was an up and comer that we find out a lot, and which we've done recently, haven't we?
Then we turn the page. I think in part, Rex, this addresses, at least at the margin, some of where you were coming from. By really talking about what it is in the private market you're looking for. And that's what that was intended to accomplish.
But I think the long-term investment relationships, as part of this, different side of the same coin of top quartile, stay with the same team, and I don't necessarily believe that. I understand the value of it in theory, but I don't think it belongs here as a prescription.
Okay. We'll look at that and come back. Number 5, A, first bullet, successfully. There's some question about what success is. Reasonable people can view success in different ways. And I think the goal here is, should we expand this so that we're more clear of what you would want out of the success? Don't have to answer that right now. You get back to me. B, that's number 12. It's just adding factor exposures, which currently isn't there. It's just another one of the metrics. So that one's, I think, low-hanging fruit. So shouldn't be any issue there. Go to 7. You're now using, you know, Glass Lewis as a proxy service, I think it would be good to define their role and how you interact with them. That's currently a little bit unclear. We would benefit by getting your direction on that, particularly to the extent that you care about some of those issues, which are the non-traditional issues, expanding that and making it clear what their role is and how you manage that and how the staff interacts is, that's important.
I think there's something missing in that. I think we've seen where proxy voting has very little impact. What would have impact is if we were able to ally ourselves with other funds where you aggregate instead of you aggregate trillions, and so that there's a. I would say Catholic obviously recognizes that aligning ourselves with other funds and a similar value has a value. I'm not suggesting wording, but
it's certainly something we do. So I think you're right.
And that was something, at least indirectly, I referenced earlier. So that would be clearly part of corporate governance.
Yeah.
And so we have our work cut out for us. So we will work on this and work with you if you want to interact with us directly again, and with the staff, and come up with another round of edits, which is what the purpose of today's meeting was for. But as your consultant, this was the kind of debate I hoped for. If we had the answers ahead of time, I would have given you a script and I said, here it is, vote on it. But it's your beliefs. It's not our beliefs. It's not the staff's beliefs. We give you input, and you have to say what works for you. So thank you for your time, and I will make my plans. I'm a happy guy.
Yeah. Before you go, though, let's open it up.
Oh, no. The clock's down, Madam Chair.
You said you were our consultant.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't have a G5 yet. You know? I don't have a G1.
So for
the Southwest.
Are you an A group or a B group?
Okay, all right. A preferred.
All right.
Now I know when you wear the polka dot socks that you'll be quite spunky. For the other board members who are really digging into the values and beliefs for the first time, are there things that you expected to see there that we haven't included? Because your eyes are fresh.
I've appreciated this, and I've been reading it and thinking about it and interacting a little bit before this meeting, so I feel good about where we're headed and recognizing there's more work to do, too.
Other than a complete reorganization. Right. Well, so one other bit of insight I think I can provide. So I manage a fund for a progressive, fully funded endowment or foundation. And in the section that talks about risk, we define it. So I'm happy to share what sort of a pretty far left view is on risk and return and our equivalent statement of values and beliefs to sort of see if there weren't that statutory constraint on us, what other boards are thinking. And that work that I did there was informed by what I hear here. So that might help you see what might happen if there weren't the statutory constraints on our on our oversight framework. Happy to share it with anybody who needs it. I'll email it to John Sherman. The ones of you who are on staff here will probably laugh out loud at some of those concepts. but at a high level, what I see that role is to de-risk some of the work that ultimately becomes more defined and can be adopted and scaled by funds like the Oregon Fund. That work, John and I are connected in our work, and that I can experiment, and then it can be measured, and once it's measured, it can be assessed, and then at that point, he can even talk about it. So I see this work as actually being quite connected. Anything else for Alan? Sold.
Nice job.
Good luck making your plan.
Let's
discussion? Oh, do you guys want open discussion? Alan, you can run.
Anybody
have any other staff? Anything that we've... This was supposed to be a discussion, and was there anything we missed that you guys would like us to talk about? Okay, they want to be out here. See you. They can play. I don't call you. Very helpful.
Yeah. We got lots to talk about. Thank you.